Coffee's ready. Guest is ready. Let's get started.
Hello and welcome back to the Prodigy Podcast. Today I'm sitting down with a winner of Grapple Fest and the British Open. And he's now got the best title in the world, which is the longest distance podcast that I've ever recorded, all the way from Nairobi, Kenya. Jack Brown. Hey, Jack.
Hello, mate. That's the only reason I moved out here, so I could get the coveted title.
I'll send a belt in the post. I don't know how long these things take or how long it would take to get a post to you, but I'm sure it might not look the same way it did when I'd send it.
Send a t-shirt as well and some money. I'm struggling out here.
Well, I mean, to jump straight into things, I guess from the quite ridiculously crazy journey that you've had in a short amount of time, from what I can see, September 2020, so what, 6 months ago now, seemed to be, you could say it was like a life-changing month for you.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'd been in the police for the past 5-6 years, just working away, just like a pretty basic life. Go to my work, train jiu-jitsu, sleep, repeat. Like, there wasn't much else to it. And I'd just been saving that whole time, pretty much. Like, I was paying rent with a mate of mine, Kieran, and that was about it. So I met my now fiancé, Ashley. We knew each other from university like 10 years ago. But I went straight into the police and she fucked off to Asia. To a completely different life path. But she's been living in Vietnam, Thailand for the past 5-6 years. Whilst I was slaving away. And we met back up, decided to go out. And then it came down to, is Ashlyn going to stay in Scotland with me or am I going to go travelling with her? And that was a very easy decision. So the police have been great about it. They've actually, I've technically not left. I'm on a career break, which means that should this all go up in flames at any point, I can go back to my old job, which is a nice little safety net. But my absolute dream is now is to leave that behind and continue with the jiu-jitsu work.
So, yeah, I mean, you had you kind of had thoughts or musings about doing this kind of trip and journey before you decided to make that big call? Like, had it always been that you wanted to go to a different country, teach jiu-jitsu, or was it more so just like a traveling kind of, you just wanted to take some time for yourself, if you will, to go traveling?
It had always been a kind of dream, but not one that I ever thought could happen, just because of, you know, the way the police is set up. Like, I can get maybe three weeks off at a time with the police, and I was using that to travel. Like, I travelled down to London for a while and trained with Jed Hugh down there and did a competition down there. And I loved doing that. I'd loved just leaving, seeing the different perspectives in jiu-jitsu in different places. London's obviously a bit higher level than Glasgow as well. So that was a nice shock for me. I got my ass kicked. and I loved it. And then obviously just things like going across to Ireland for Samurai. I did that, went across to Lisbon for the Europeans, and I just loved it every time. But it was always these very short trips, just because that was my holiday, you know, going and doing jiu-jitsu. It wasn't until I started speaking to Ashton and, you know, realising that actually long-term trips are a possibility that I thought it could be done. But then I had to work something out with the police. But luckily they were very nice about it. They let me do it.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because what you're doing right now is kind of the dream in so many ways for people. A, just training, but also being able to kind of, you know, train at places, a variety of places. So I've got three noted down, but I may have missed some. Serbia, Greece, and Kenya.
Yeah,
obviously is the last one. So, yeah. It's quite interesting because they're three very different grappling cultures.
Yeah. I've kind of found that, like, the way that that countries have different cultures, you can see it and you can feel it on the mats. Like, Greece as a whole is a very laid back place. and the rolling style was quite laid back as well. That, you know, I went in and it was what, lapel stuff, they like their gi, very chilled. And then you've got something like Serbia where it's like a, it's a hard culture. Like the 6-year-olds there could do me in, man. The guys are just solid. And you could tell, like, the second you started rolling with them, it was heavy takedowns, MMA base, heavy pressure. So yeah, it's cool.
And I mean, it's interesting that you have that parallel, because is it purely because there? I mean, is there just a really significant, well, a more so significant MMA base in Serbia, and that's why it's just so? I mean, obviously there's a wrestling culture there as well, but it's so MMA focused over there.
Yeah, I mean, I was training, I was coaching in Kimura BJJ, which is part of the Achilles MMA team. So like, even when I was teaching in the gi, there'd be a set of mats next door that they were doing like kickboxing and stuff. So yeah, it was very heavily MMA based, but they loved the Greco-Roman stuff as well. Yeah, and I think it's just the culture as well. They are a hard people. I don't know if it's like the harsh winters, but they're hard people.
It's a bit like the kind of whatever's in the Dagestani winter is in the Serbian cold as well.
Exactly, mate. They're close enough that they're getting some of that shit.
And I guess from that, then how have you felt that your own jiu-jitsu that you've seen, you know, you spent quite a significant time teaching and learning in each of those countries. How have you found that from training in a regular place and having that structure of learning to moving to a country where there are different focuses and things like that? How have you found that?
It's been amazing, yeah. It's dropped a little bit in Kenya just because the level's not quite there yet in comparison with the European places, sorry. But Serbia was game-changing for me. Like, I'm known very much in the competition scene as a dirty guard puller. I've never really wrestled in any competition that I've done. But honestly, after a few months in Serbia, just the techniques that they showed and the hard training, I think I would feel quite comfortable going back to the UK and testing my stand-up out, which is definitely something I couldn't have said 6 months ago.
It's definitely... It's just one of those things where I don't know. I guess depends on what gym you are in the UK. Leg locking is standard, if you will. it's the same way over there. It's like if you have a stand up game, it doesn't matter whether you're training in BJJ or MMA. You have a stand up game.
Yeah, absolutely. When I say the 6 year olds could do me in, I wasn't lying, man. Their toddlers are great wrestlers. So it's hard. It's hard not to pick up some stuff when you're training with them every day.
And is there then moving on to the stuff that you've done in Kenya, it's almost like I was thinking about it and I was thinking about what questions to ask and things like that. I think what is most fascinating is that you've got three very distinct countries. You've got a country that has made mostly a kind of competition BJJ led with Greece. You have MMA quite stand up heavy, just generally tough country in Serbia in terms of their grappling. And then Kenya is like, when you look at it, I mean, from what I see, you know, there is an importance on the self-defense side, but also it's just new. It's like a jiu-jitsu baby, if you will, a grappling baby. It really is in its infancy.
Yeah, like obviously I wasn't around for jiu-jitsu in the UK and America in the 90s, but that here is what I imagine it was like. The moment you start showing jiu-jitsu or talking about jiu-jitsu, immediately you have to prove to that person that it works, because straight off the bat they don't believe you. You know, I'm showing moves in Mombasa and the new guys are stopping me every 2 seconds to say, I would just poke you in the eyes when you did that to me. Or, you know, you're doing this triangle, but then I would punch you in the face. And it's like, you have to take it all back, you know. And it really is like what I imagine the 90s is like. You have to say to them, look, try and poke me in the eyes. Try and poke me in the eyes. And then you choke them. And then they start coughing. And then they're like, okay, jiu-jitsu is not too bad. And it is. You have to prove to people here that jiu-jitsu is a viable option. So that's why, I kind of had the self-defense aspect anyway, just from the police, because you work out ways to use your jiu-jitsu when drunk people are trying to punch you. But I rely on it heavily here, because if I take a newbie here and go straight to playing Delhi Heaver from guard in the gi, they're walking out the door. Yeah, I mean they don't understand what's going on. They're just the whole time they're thinking, oh, I would just stomp in his balls. You have to kind of start from that self-defense aspect, get them into jiu-jitsu, get them believing that it's a viable option, and then you can start showing them armbar from close guard, you know.
Yeah. How have you found that? I mean, I don't know. I know that part of the reason that you got into jiu-jitsu was from a self-defense perspective, but how have you felt teaching it from that approach? Have you ever had to go, right, this is how you look after yourself? Oh, by the way, we do this thing called De La Hiva afterwards and things like that. How do you take that approach?
It's hard. So if it's a brand newbie, I just do self-defense. And what I do is I'll get them to try. And there's a guy, you might know him up in Scotland, Craig McIntosh, Mop. He was on Grapple Fist, quite a well-known grappler in Scotland. Starting to make a name for himself in the UK. He put up a Facebook video a few years ago, and what he did was he got an MMA class. He put everyone, and some of them were experienced guys, and he put them in his close guard, and he said, right, I want you to try and knock me out. And he was just tapping everyone from close guard. Really cool video, and it was like a really good example to me that you need to, with beginners, you really have to demonstrate that jiu-jitsu works before you can start telling them about inverted De La Hiva to outside Ashia. But you know, you have to actually teach them that if you try and fight me in the street, I'm going to use these skills to nullify you. So for newbies, all self-defense until they start believing that jiu-jitsu is a viable option, and then we can look at, by the way, this is also a cool sport that you can do. But yeah, it's all self-defense for me just now, because guys just don't believe me when I tell them it's a good option.
Yeah, it really is that kind of, you know, the Gracies turn up at the UFC and go, oh, I'm here to fight in my pajamas, and people are like, nah. And you know, you have not a point to prove, but you know, you do have to justify essentially why you would roll around on the floor when you're in a fight and things like that. Why exactly. Why would you take someone down?
We got that. I mean, we had that exact scenario. We were doing some beach wrestling, and this big guy was walking past, and he just started with, that wouldn't work on me, I'd punch you, I'd poke you in the eye, I'd kick you in the balls. And I was teaching, so I just kind of brushed it off. But then one of the blue belts, Sammy, came over, and he was like, you do that to me then, do that to me. And just Sammy, straight away, Sammy's quite a big guy himself. Easy double leg, easy mount. Sat on him for a little while until the guy tired himself out. Proper Gracie shit, you know. And that was just a blue belt, so that's really cool to see. It's good for passers-by to see as well.
That's also quite cool, and thanks that the little bit of you go, oh, I'm so glad I don't have to fucking fight this guy.
I don't know, I was going to gut it. It would have been a good, it'd been a great Instagram post. beating the shit out of passers-by on a beach. But no, Sammy stepped in for me.
So let's kind of trail back a bit. How did you essentially go, you know, choose your path of what led you to go through these three countries and now, well, I guess four cities now?
Yeah. Cool. So Ashton, my fiance, was out in Thailand and in Vietnam. I kind of looked at it and thought Thailand would be the best place for me. They're more into the martial arts. There's more kind of set up gyms out there, but they're quite obviously Muay Thai based. And I thought maybe there's a space for me there to teach people who have got high level Muay Thai, but maybe don't have as high level jiu-jitsu and they want to go into MMA. I was thinking that could be my niche to get me over there and get me a little bit of money. And also just as a higher level of training partners for me, because as I'm finding in Kenya, like, it is tough to go long periods of time without purple, brown, black belts to train with. Asia to this day is still closed, like every country, I think. I think you can get into Thailand at this point, but it's so expensive. They've set so many expensive hoops that I just can't jump through just now, so I'm waiting for that to open. So we didn't have a set plan. Greece was the first stop because it was sunny. that was pretty much it. We thought, well, you know, I've got some savings. We'll have a mini holiday for a month, and then COVID will go away, and then we can go to Thailand. That was the plan. About a month and a half in, realised that was not the case. And then Greece went into full lockdown. I was about to go into full lockdown. I think we had like 3 or 4 days to get out before it did. So I desperately put up posts in different Facebook groups saying, does anyone need a coach? We'll teach arm bars for food kind of thing. and really luckily, Gilly Hooney, the guy who owns BJJ Eastern Europe, and Kimura out in Serbia, he got in touch saying that he was looking for a coach. So that was Serbia booked. We left the next day to try and avoid the COVID impact, and then we were there. A few months in Serbia. Serbia was amazing for me, jiu-jitsu wise. Such a high level of guys. It was good for me to get my ass kicked again. But the weather was a bit of a the weather wasn't great. It was going to
crazy. It wasn't the sun that you were hoping for after going from Greece.
Exactly. We wanted to keep that little holiday going until. Because I mean, the whole time we're doing this entire traveling experience, we're thinking Thailand's going to open next week, so it's all good. And then it just never has. So we have this in our minds the whole time, and we're thinking we need to keep it interesting and, you know, keep ourselves entertained until Thailand opens. So after a few months in Serbia, jumped in Skyscanner, and Kenya popped up as an option, and. As anyone who does jiu-jitsu does, the moment they see a new country, they Google that country at jiu-jitsu to see where they can go. And this charity called the Lionheart Initiative popped up. So I got in touch with them. And like before, all the travels were kind of based around what jiu-jitsu can I do to earn a little bit of money so I can feed myself. But reading what Lionheart were doing, it was kind of like, this is a chance to, you know, not do something just for money, for food, just actually do something that is beneficial for people and actually give back a little bit. Like jiu-jitsu has given me so much, and if teaching for free for a couple of months gives a little back, then I'm more than happy to do that. So that was how I decided in Kenya.
And it was so tell me a little bit about the Lionheart Initiative for people who don't really know what it's about.
So if you are any form of high level martial arts, I'd say decent blue belt, purple belt above, or some good experience in kickboxing, wrestling, anything at all. If you've got a good level of experience in the martial art, Lionheart will team up with you and basically help you set up a series of free seminars or coaching sessions for people in impoverished communities in Africa. And that is pretty much it. It's basically just, if there's high-level martial artists in Africa or who plan to go to Africa, why don't we get them teaching what they know to people that could really use it? So Mombasa is like a highly impoverished community. Not the whole city, obviously, but where I was teaching. And for me, it's just about giving something back. Just the guys were already set up. The coach there, Imran, has actually been coaching longer than me. But he's still a blue belt just because there's no black belt or higher level guy like leading the way. These guys are still gelling techniques that some traveling black belt taught them 5 years ago. You know, they do a lot with what they have.
And what for yourself, like seeing it where, you know, people are they're learning what people teach them. They can't. No, they're not necessarily finding the latest Craig Jones YouTube video, Lachlan Giles YouTube video, and breaking it down and testing it out.
Yeah.
And having jiu-jitsu in quite a raw form, if you will. How did you find stepping into that and meeting people who you know were so focused on? I guess there's such attentiveness in that class because of the fact that you are the source of knowledge, if you will.
Hands down, the quickest learners I will ever teach in my life. so attentive, man. And I think it's just because they know that, like, whatever I'm showing them, they're going to be drilling for however long until the next guy comes along, you know. So usually, like, my classes are kind of structured. We'll do maybe like 2 or 3 moves, and then we'll go into specific sparring and then some rolling after. Some days I was teaching these guys 4, 5, 6 techniques in one class, just because it was like, you know. So for example, the Danaher, I don't know if the Danaher triangle is quite different, yeah, from your traditional triangle. You know, he's spinning off to the side, he's opening his legs, focusing, putting the knee in front of the shoulder. Very different from your traditional triangle, where you're in line with the guy and you pull in the back of the head and you squeeze. So I'm thinking I'm probably going to take 2 or 3 classes to explain why I'm doing this triangle so differently, where I learned it from, why it's I think it's superior to the normal triangle. And they picked it up within 10 minutes. just everyone hitting it better than me. Just because they're just, just so attentive. So we got through a lot of stuff much more than what I'd planned to. And that was just, they have such a deep love for the sport and they're so grateful that someone's come out to teach them. They're so attentive. So great bunch of guys.
And you started a fundraiser to get them some new mats.
Yeah. So I don't know if you've seen like the pictures of how they were training when I arrived. They have a spare room in the back of a mosque, just bang centre where they all live. They all walk to the gym. You can't really call it a gym. It's like a little hall. There must be about 20, 30 mats just now, enough for about maybe 8 people to roll max. And that's like, we're all bumping into each other, bumping heads. The mats are just on concrete floors. There's no, you know, there's no matting on the wall. So if you hit the wall, you're going home with a sore head. It's in the same room as like the food bank. So like, I would be teaching and guys would just be coming in to get like pots of soup and stuff like that. Just a really kind of rough place to try and teach jiu-jitsu. So the mats weren't the cleanest. So it's impossible to improve that just now because the guys don't pay any membership. If that was like my gym, I would save up the monthly memberships and I'd do improvements as we go. That's not an option for those guys. So the GoFundMe was just to give them that cash injection that they need to get whatever they need, cleaning products for the mats, additional mats which have now been purchased. We've been really fortunate. Lots of kind people have donated lots of gis, no gi stuff, so gear. Just to give them that stuff that they can use to actually give a good jiu-jitsu class. Because right now, when it comes to rolling, about half of them have to sit and watch from the side. And the half that are rolling are constantly having to watch their head in case they roll into the concrete, hit the walls, roll into someone else's foot. That was the premise behind that.
And you did get to see the fruition of the fundraising. You end up going to Nairobi, right, afterwards?
Yeah, unfortunately. So the initial plan was to buy the mats in Africa, which would mean I was going to be there for it. But the mats weren't the best quality, so we ended up ordering from China, which is going to take maybe may even be another month. I'm not entirely sure. I need to ask Imran. Unfortunately for me, like, I loved my time at the Sharks and I'm definitely going to visit again whilst I'm still in Kenya. But it's just difficult for me. I was earning zero money from everything I was doing, which doesn't bother me. I'm not a money orientated person, but just I need to pay rent or I'm going to be homeless. So there's no appetite for paid classes in Mombasa. The guys who want to do jiu-jitsu probably can't afford to pay, and the guys in Mombasa who do have money aren't usually interested in jiu-jitsu. They tend to be probably older expats and stuff like that. So Nairobi's got a much bigger population base. So that's why I moved out here. There's guys out here who have already set up. There's a second degree black belt, Julio de Souza, who I'm working with. And we're working together to try and build a new gym, which is called Nairobi Fight Lab. So that's starting up soon.
It's quite interesting because I guess we don't see a huge amount of people coming out of Kenya specifically, or kind of the African continent, high level BJJ guys. But there is, you know, there's A, an appetite there, and B, there's also, you know, a building, a growing base, just within Kenya itself.
Yeah, definitely. It's just a stage they're at. They're just unfortunately, you know, maybe a decade or so behind us. And it's the same reason why, you know, you could probably say that the Americans are doing better than the Europeans just now. And again, that's just because they started earlier than us. You know, the Brazilians started it. They were the best. It took the Americans a little bit of time to catch up. Now they're at a similar level. I think within a couple of years, you're going to see Europeans at that level too. I mean, of course, they already are, Ross Nichols and stuff like that, and guys in Europe. They already are at that level, but I think you'll see more. We'll start to catch up. And I think Kenya's just unfortunate. Well, Africa as a whole, it's just a little bit lower down that line at this time. But huge potential. Like, the guys they're so committed. The general health of the public is like, I'm coming from Scotland, land of the deep fried everything. So there's no fat people here. it's such a culture shock coming from Scotland. The public,
it's all strong rolls.
What's that, man?
It's all really strong. Like, you know, when you get the new guy and they're all that one new guy who comes into the gym who's quite strong. Well, all of the new guys are really strong there.
Oh, 100%. So I get in Serbia, I get my ass thoroughly kicked by a guy called Jovan. And he was just crazy strong. And I had to ask him straight away, what do you do for strength training? He says, I don't really touch weights. But I can do this. And then he started doing this crazy handstand stuff. Just crazy calisthenics, what you say?
Yeah, I think so.
All this crazy stuff. So I was like, I've got to learn that. So from Serbia, I've been working really hard and trying to do handstands, headstands, all that gymnastic stuff. So like I was in Mombasa, and like every day before class, I'd be trying my handstands. And these guys are coming off the street and they can just do them 10 times better than me. Which really pissed me off. Like, this 20-year-old guy who's never done a handstand in his life will just walk into the gym and do a perfect handstand. So obviously I had to kick the shit out of him and roll to make myself feel better. But yeah, no, just your average guy here is crazy athletic. And as soon as they start learning high-level jiu-jitsu, they're going to make a big dent, I think.
And do you think... because in different countries, we see that in the Eastern European country, generally in like the general public and how a country reveres grappling sports, they, you know, they place it quite highly. What's the consensus, if you will? You know, what's it like in Kenya? How do people look at grappling arts and martial arts?
Well, I know just from seeing YouTube videos and stuff, I know that Africans are into the wrestling. I think Senegal, the guys there are like crazy into the wrestling. So I did kind of expect a little bit of that when I arrived. But to be honest, I really haven't seen that in Kenya. There's a lot of Taekwondo schools. The guys really believe in Taekwondo. And I think it is just kind of like the UK back in the 80s, 90s. I think striking arts are... much more highly revered than grappling arts. That's my personal experience. Like, there might be some crazy high level Kenyan wrestler who disputes everything I just said. But I've really not seen any. If there was a good wrestling class in Mombasa, Nairobi, I'd be there. You know, so I've looked for it and I haven't found it. So far, but yeah, it seems to be striking based just now. They're very into the Taekwondo, a lot of Muay Thai in Nairobi anyway. But really nothing grappling.
Might be that similar to the UK, the classic kind of, I've watched a few movies and seen that people throw lots of kicks and punches, and so striking is the way and that kind of thing.
Genuinely, man, I just think that's where Kenya's at. I think that's just where the UK was back then. I think we just need to get the UFC 1 footage broadcast across Kenya and just get that movement going.
Well, unlike... UFC 1, I think it's safe to say that it's not that you have a hate for the gi, but you have a preference, let's say, for no gi and not having those stupid lapel things around, would you say?
The cheating handles?
The cheating handles, yeah, that's what we'll call
them. When I'm trying to do jiu-jitsu and someone grabs me and I can't move. Dirty bastards, man. I don't mind the gi. It's just a running joke that I have. I much, much prefer no gi. I prefer to watch it. I prefer to do it. All my grappling heroes are the no gi guys. I love Gordon. I love Craig. Lachlan Giles. These are all the guys that I like to watch. But I still do the gi. Kenyans, the Kenyans that are established here and do jiu-jitsu, they actually prefer the gi. So I've had the gi on quite a lot whilst I've been here.
I bet you've tried to change that, though.
Yeah, I've tried every excuse in the book, mate. I don't have one with me. These are new shorts. I really want to try them out. I've tried them all, mate. It doesn't work. They're too nice. They give me spares. They give me belts. Does my head in.
I don't think you'd ever get away with in the UK. These are new shorts. I really want to try them out.
You've got to try it, mate.
I guess you've got to try it.
But I mean, another thing is like the guys here, leg locks are completely alien to them. So it's not something I've not really done a heel hook in the past 2 or 3 months. It's what I always like to do, but it's like you kind of have to teach them normal jiu-jitsu before you start getting into that stuff. So it has been more gi-based, and I've been laying off the leg locks because I can't go from, you know, these guys don't know an armbar or a triangle and then saying, here's an Aminari into inside heel hook, you know. So it has been more basics-based.
Does that mean you've got like the leg lock shakes? You haven't done them for a while now and you're pandering.
I've rolled with there's a brown belt out here who I met for the first time, Teddy. He runs One Tribe. And I just went crazy with the heel hooks, man. Because I was like, he can take them. He knows. So I got all my heel hook frustration for the past 3 months out in Teddy on Saturday. It was amazing.
And so when you're now kind of looking, obviously training in and setting up a gym in Asia is still your end goal, right?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I don't know anything about Asia. I've never been there. I'm relying on what I can find out online, and I'm relying on what my fiance can tell me. Obviously, my fiance is very knowledgeable about Asia as a whole, but she's never done martial arts in her life, and she has absolutely no interest in doing jiu-jitsu. So there would definitely be a feeling out process where I go over. I would just train with as many people as I can, not set up anything right away, and then just trying to see, like, you know, what city, what place could use some jiu-jitsu, where is there interest for jiu-jitsu? Because I think Phuket, I think I looked into it and there's like 20 gyms there. They don't need a brown belt coming over and teaching heel hooks. They're cool. So it'd just be about doing a little bit of traveling, experiencing the country or the continent, and then deciding, you know, is there a place here that could use me and would want me? And I'm sure there will be.
Is there any particular countries or gyms that you want to go train at as out of just personal interest and because you want to see what the jiu-jitsu is like there?
Yeah, I mean, everyone says Tiger in Maine is a must. I've heard really good things about Bali MMA. And I'm a big Robert Deagle fan. I really like Robert's approach to jiu-jitsu, and we go back and forth sometimes on Instagram. It's mostly just me telling him how great he is. He's now teaching at Singapore Evolution. So I would love to spend some time there and pick up some heel hook details from Robert at some point.
I'm pretty sure Evolution is, if not the biggest, one of the biggest, and just in terms of sheer size of the MMA gym in the world.
Yeah, perfect. That'd be great to spend some time with.
Yeah, and I guess the interesting thing is that you'll have almost seen, bar one, you'll have done BJJ on every continent or almost every continent by that point.
Oh, I don't think so, man. I did go in the
whole. Got the Americas, right?
Yeah, I've got the Americas, Asia. I think I've only done Europe and Africa so far. So I've got a few to go.
You, You'll go through the list. You need to go give Lachlan Charles a visit anyway.
Oh, yeah, actually, good point. That would be my number one. I wasn't sure if we count Australia and Asia. But yeah, I'm close enough that is my number one gym to visit. It'd be amazing.
So
there's an up-and-coming gym in Puerto Rico as well that I might visit. Had good things.
And how are you finding like reaching out and finding out about these things? Is it quite, because I know, you know, everyone can set up a Facebook page, if you will, but I'm sure there are some gyms out there that, you know, don't really advertise. You're not able to easily find them on Google and things like that.
Oh, it's an absolute nightmare in Kenya. They don't advertise at all. One Tribe is the kind of, I'd say it's like the most established gym in Kenya. You really wouldn't know they're there unless you knew in advance they were called One Tribe. They're very difficult to find. And even once you find them, it's very difficult to actually get in touch with them. But really great bunch of guys. It's just the owner, he's not doing it for money. He's not trying to expand his business. It's just a pure love of jiu-jitsu. So he doesn't really advertise it. It's him and his mates training jiu-jitsu. And if you can find them, it's great to go along because it's a good level. But very difficult to actually find stuff here in Kenya, which is what I'm actually starting in the past week. I'm trying to change. I'm trying to get advertising going. I'm starting a beginner's course in Nairobi. And just what you would do if you were starting a gym in the UK, advertise, get beginners in the door, teach them a curriculum. I'm trying to set all that up just now.
And I guess it's almost the best way to field test, to practice setting up a gym, because if you could bring people in who, you know, where BJJ isn't maybe commonplace or even in people's minds, something that people would consider, maybe more so in countries where there's an MMA base at least. Well, if you can convince people and get an established class in there, then, you know, you're laughing for other places.
100%, mate. If I can set up a gym here, I can set up anywhere. And, you know, like even just doing this, you find out the little tricks. I tried to set up paid classes in Mombasa and I advertise it as jiu-jitsu beginner's course. One person turned up. So now it's come and learn jiu-jitsu as seen in MMA. you find out the little tricks that get people to turn their heads. And I think the self-defense thing is big for guys here. So I'm leaning heavily in the self-defense aspect.
And is that something that you've, let's say we jump 5 years ahead and you've got a gym in whichever country you're in. Is that something that you still want to continue to do? Have you kind of, now that you've trained a considerable and taught a considerable amount of time in Kenya, is that something that has reignited the want to focus on some self-defense aspects for you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think there's very few people in the world that start jiu-jitsu with a view to becoming a jiu-jitsu world champion or just doing jiu-jitsu. Like everyone that walks in the door, they tend not to know what jiu-jitsu is, but they want to learn how to fight, how to defend themselves. You know, if someone comes at me and throws punches, I want to know how to survive that situation. I think that's the majority. I would say that's the majority of people's thinking when they walk into a jiu-jitsu gym. It just so happens once you get in there that you fall in love with the sport, and like 2 weeks later you end up doing inversions into cross ashi or whatever. I think very few people walk into a jiu-jitsu gym with a full knowledge of the sport thinking, you know, I want to do inversions and I want to play sport jiu-jitsu for points. I think most people walk in wanting some self-defense training. So, and I kind of had to adapt my jiu-jitsu for the police, because obviously if I need to put a guy in the jail, I'm not pulling guard. So my jiu-jitsu was out the window straight away and I had to really focus on getting behind people quickly, taking people down to the ground without throwing them on their head, because then I'd lose my job. So it's just these elements kind of translate nicely into a street fight, and I just teach the stuff that I worked in the police.
And I mean, that is almost, is something that you've always kept in mind as well, given that's kind of, is that the real reason, or the first reason that you got into jiu-jitsu was from a kind of self-defense perspective for the police?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, part of it was I knew I was going to join the police. And I think it was my dad's just made the good point that, you know, some martial arts training would be good for you if you're going to be doing that. If you're going into nightclubs and chucking people out, that kind of bouncer work, you're going to need some kind of martial arts. So I didn't really know what jiu-jitsu was. I was a bit of a UFC fan. And just at the same time, I was a young guy, 19, 20. You do want to know a little bit just in case you are outside a pub and something happens. You'd like to be able to think you're not going to get knocked out and, you know, straight away. So that was my reason for getting into it. And then I remember my first class, it was going in, my coach, Marcus Nardini, he didn't really talk to me. He just said, look, jump into the class, do what the guys are doing. And if you like it, you can stay, kind of thing. And the first thing I ever did in jiu-jitsu was I put on a gi. I went into a guy's closed guard and I stood up 20 times. So we're in the closed guard, stand up, back down, stand up. And absolutely, it was a workout. My thighs were burning, my abs were burning. I had no fucking idea why I was doing it. It's this is reasonably fun. I'm getting a good workout. But there's a guy in pajamas with his legs around my back and I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm not even getting out. I'm just standing up and sitting down. But I mean, luckily, Marcus is a great coach and I stuck with it. And obviously, I understand the benefits of doing that exercise, but I think for a guy who's just walked through the door, it's good to take him to the side and say, look, this art works. If you get attacked in the street, here's a few quick things you can do. And if you like that, you can stay for years and you can become an expert.
You can become a big leg lock master and
you can end up
the fuck out of people.
Rolling about on your ass, tickling people's toes for little money.
So, I guess when you talked a lot, and you really don't look towards coaching in your future, but you've also competed quite a bit. We mentioned at the beginning, you've competed on shows like Grapplefest. Given that you are on the move, if you will, is your ambition still to continue competing? And if so, in what way do you want to shape that?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'll compete until, the day I stop doing jiu-jitsu, which is probably when I'm dead. But yeah, I wasn't particularly proud of my competition record in white and blue and even early purple. It was only really in the year leading up to COVID coming out that I started to kind of believe myself a bit more in competition and realise that I could stack up a few wins. And I was really gutted that COVID hit just as I felt like I was starting to get somewhere with competing. Getting on Grapple Fest was huge for me. I was really lucky that I got a quick win, a quick submission win, which I was really hoping would get me invited back. And I really felt like that was my competition career, like starting. I'd competed since, I think my first competition was 4 months into white belt, but I never did particularly well. And just as I kind of hit middle of purple belt, I felt like I was starting to get somewhere with it because it was just a mental thing. I get very nervous when I compete. So I think from middle purple belt onwards, my technique was at a point where I was just starting to take off, and then COVID ruined all that. So the second I can compete, I'll be straight back in there.
And it's quite interesting. Do you find that, how did you kind of pass that hurdle of getting, because everyone gets nerves on when they step on the mat. Was there something that you did, or was there something that kind of clicked for you?
A couple of things. I think just competing so much that I started to get comfortable helped. I was always kind of taught that when you go into competition, you want to get amped, you want to get angry, you want to slap yourself in the face and then run out there and do it. I found out that that's really not my style. That the lazier and the more calm I can walk out onto the mats, the better for me. I just need to have nothing going on in my mind, as opposed to some people, it works really well. They'll have in their head, I'm going to smash this guy. I'm going to kill him. I'm going to run at him. I found out that's just not for me. I need to be like almost chilled out to the point where I'm going for a nap before I go out. It's just my style. Another big thing was I really started to get into like my jiu-jitsu instructionals. I think a big part of the reason why my jiu-jitsu wasn't working as well in competition was that I didn't really have any idea what I was doing. You know, if you asked me before I went out, what you're going to do to this guy, I'd say, oh, I'm going to do some jiu-jitsu and hopefully I'll win. You know, I wasn't thinking I'm going to try the triangle or I'm going to focus on the legs. But instructionals really gave, I mean, especially Dana stuff, it's so systematic. Like, Dana will say, if opponent does this, you do X or Y or Z. And having that kind of almost like a mind map in my head really helped with competition. You know, if my opponent grabs me here, here's an option I can do. And then you always have in your head something, you know, an option. And I think having that chilled me out a little bit, as opposed to I'm going to run out and see what happens, which didn't work for me.
And I guess that can be quite, for some people, they find that, I mean, at the moment, instructionals are the only thing that we're going on by. It's our drip feed of jiu-jitsu, if you will.
Yep.
But it's something that sometimes people struggle with when they struggle ingesting that, or once you've kind of, you know, watched it, you've taken notes, whatever, and then kind of going out and applying that or practicing it in a way that it really cements it in your mind. For those people who do struggle, is there any advice you'd give?
Yes, I think I've gotten pretty good at this just through necessity. You know, I wasn't doing it as much in Glasgow because, like, you would learn something from an instructional, but then I had a really high level black belt in Marcus teaching me a move, so I didn't have to rely as much on an instructional. But as I've been traveling, I've not had a full time coach, so the instructionals really have. They really have been my full-time coach, you know. For me, how I kind of ingest the moves that I see, I'll maybe watch like an hour, 2 hours max. I'll take notes on exactly what I'm looking at. So let's say, for example, I've got, what have I been watching recently? Craig Jones. He's got a really good section of triangles in his latest DVD. I'll watch an hour or two of triangles. I'll take notes on exactly what he's doing, where he's putting his feet and his hands. And then I'll go into the gym and I'll roll with the white belts, the blue belts, sometimes if they're there, purple belts. And I'll say to myself, I'm only finishing these guys with the Craig Jones triangle today. You know, I don't care if they give me their foot in the plat, we're leaving that alone. As hard as that is for me. I'm just finishing these guys with the Craig Jones triangle. And not like, not just a triangle, it has to be the way Craig Jones does it. You know, like the way he sets it up. And I think that gets you a kind of live repetition of drilling. And especially, I mean, if you are a brown belt and you're fighting blue belts, you're going to hit that triangle anyway, just because you're a higher level than them. And for me, that's kind of how I get it into my mind. Because then you start to see, right, what's the common reactions? You know, when I grab his hand, does he posture? Does he come forward? And that's how I kind of learn from instructionals.
I guess it's really changed your perspective on self-learning. We do put this onus on, especially during times of COVID. Oh, I said it.
the new normal.
Especially during like periods like this where we aren't able, we're so reliant on, and it's very easy to go, well, I've got my coach in my gym. You know, that's my source. That's my fountain of knowledge. I'm not really concerned how much. And sometimes when you try and add to that, it can get all a bit murky. And, you know, it's hard to focus on an instructional if someone's teaching you something in a class as well. But when you're the coach and you're, you know, the people you're rolling with are at a lower level, I guess that helps direct your focus a little more.
Yeah. I mean, another thing I would say is my coach, Marcus, is an amazing coach, amazing competitor. He was just in Polaris recently. But he is really quite gi-focused, and his style is very different to mine. something that he, I mean, it's something that he encourages. He likes people to have different styles. But for me, like, in kind of 2017, maybe 2016, I was seeing this emerging trend of leg lockers. Like, the Death Squad were just ruining people with, like, what we would now say are, like, very basic heel hooks. And me and, like, a group of the guys around my level in the gym could see that coming a mile away. Like, I think everyone could. So it really helped us, like, a group of us, maybe three or four of us, would watch the instructionals together and really focus on the leg game, because as amazing as Marcus is, like, he wasn't very well versed in the leg game at the time. So we would learn, you know, whatever he's teaching at the time, gi stuff, X-guard, whatever. And then an hour after class, we'd just spend on instructional leg stuff, whatever we felt was the kind of cutting edge stuff at the time. I think that helps as well. So if you can get like a small group of people who are committed to learning whatever the cool new thing is at the time, I think that helps, definitely.
So, I mean, it'd be remiss for me to not mention back home. This kind of leads on to the questions that people have asked as well. But first off, in terms of, you know, you're training back home and competing back home, obviously there's not much to miss at the moment in terms of jiu-jitsu.
Yep.
But have you had any kind of, I've forgotten the word for it. Essentially, have you missed anything from home in terms of jiu-jitsu? Is there anything that you've gone, I look forward to kind of seeing that?
What, like, sorry, I don't understand the question. Like, people...
have you missed training back in Scotland? Is there anything in mind that you, anything that you've, you know, you look forward to going back to, if you will?
Oh yeah, so much. I mean, the gym in Scotland, like, it's really underrated. Like, I've been obviously traveling around and going to different gyms. The level at MMBJJ is, like, it's so much higher than even I thought it was. So many black belts there now, and yeah, definitely miss it. Like, we were always really good for, you know, if class was like 6 to 7, we'd be there from 3, just messing around, open mats, instructionals, drilling, rolling. And I definitely miss that. Like, when you're teaching class here, if the class is at 6, it starts at 6. There's not a lot of school. I'm trying to introduce that, because I think that's how you get good fast, is having that hour or two where you are just messing around and rolling. But I miss that especially. And of course, all the guys at the gym. They've become close friends over the years.
I guess jiu-jitsu in some ways it's been nice that you get to have that thing that you go and, you know, you'll see in no matter what country you go to, you'll get to have that home away from home.
Yeah. I can go to any country in the world and make 10 new friends. It's really good. Yeah, that's been great. It's probably one of the nicest things about jiu-jitsu.
And just to go back to Serbia for a second, one of the things I was going to ask, you know, you talk about leg locking quite a lot, and that you're a guard puller, but is that something now that you're a bit more confident in teaching now that you've gone to Kenya, and something that you'll go on to teach? Have you felt more confident in teaching that kind of stand-up wrestling?
Yeah, 100%. I try to really focus. The kind of weird dynamic though was that the Serbian guys really wanted to learn leg locks, because it was quite new to them, and like, obviously I come with the reputation of being a guard puller, so they really wanted to know that stuff, which is what I had to teach a lot of the time. But I really wanted to learn their wrestling, so luckily there was a wrestling class that I could go, like, as a student rather than a coach, and I picked up so many things there. Really high level wrestling coaching out there. More concepts and techniques, you know, like, which kind of allows me to make some of my own stuff up and teach that.
That's quite interesting. They teach the wrestling more so in kind of conceptual stuff rather than set techniques every time.
Yeah. I'm going to struggle to explain it because they're just so much better at it than I am. But, yeah, just I don't think I can bring the words for it. You'd have to go and experience it for yourself. It's very high level coaching, and in an hour, I feel like they could show me a concept that I could apply to 100 techniques rather than just teach me a technique.
It just goes to show how you know what level the stand up is over there. It's, you know, we talk about working in jiu-jitsu and working in concepts for jiu-jitsu and for different areas of jiu-jitsu, whether it be kind of leg locks or controlling the hip or something like that.
Yeah.
But we don't ever really consider concepts for stand-up grappling.
Yeah, 100%. I'd say that the way Danaher teaches his jiu-jitsu is kind of how they would teach their wrestling. You know, Danaher, like, so we would all say that we know how to do armbar from close guard. But then Danaher says something as simple as get your knee above his ear. And everyone's like, oh, that is what we do. We just didn't know. You know, we didn't know we were doing that. It's kind of similar with the wrestling over there.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant to hear about. Right. Well, I think we best get onto the user submitted questions because they've been sitting in front of me.
I'm terrified.
And I don't think there's only one that, well, two maybe. So we'll jump straight in, which is we'll go with a nice one first. What is Jack's favorite comp win?
Favorite competition win? Probably the final of the openweight no-gi that we did in December 2019. I went out in my weight class, I think in the second or the third match. I just get beaten points, wasn't too happy with myself. And then I jumped into the absolute, got a couple of quick footlock wins. And then I was in the final. I really can't remember the guy's name, but I'll send you a picture, man. He was like 6'4", like bodybuilder, ex-Marine. And he had just been smashing people, like just chucking them in their head. And I met him in the final and I almost didn't bother. I almost just went home. I'll take the silver, mate. That's fine. But I managed to footlock him. And I footlocked, he's just massive, obviously massive leg. And I footlocked him so hard that I had nerve damage in my arm for like a year after. But thank God he tapped. So it's probably my favourite win just because I completely ruined myself doing it.
That's the first time I've heard about someone leg locking someone so hard that they hurt themselves.
Oh, there's a blue belt in Scotland. His name's Doogie. He completely broke his arm footlocking someone. Completely snapped it in two. And I think I might be wrong here, but I think he still has a metal plate in his arm to this day.
What was he doing?
I think he was doing a footlock very wrong.
That's got to be really wrong to break your arm.
Yeah, I think like if you put your arm higher up the foot, you're going against the calf bone, whatever that's called, rather than the ankle. So obviously that's a lot harder to break. And an arm bone is probably going to break before a calf bone. So he must just have been super committed to finishing it. I was right in the ankle, he did tap, but it was just a fucking big leg.
Well, I mean, I credit to you. I mean, if there's any time where you've got, oh, you need to put more effort into your leg locks, where you can say, well, I gave myself nerve damage, so.
It was horrible. It was like, anytime anything touched my forearm for about a year, it felt like a funny bone hit. Oof. So it felt like it was this horrible feeling.
Arm drags were not fun then.
Oh, jiu-jitsu wasn't fun as a whole. But I'm better now. I'm all good.
Happy days. Okay, next question. Will he ever get a tan or will he... will he ever get a tan or will he always be transparent?
I will remain proudly Scottish. Until the day I die. That was the extra weight.
Sam Quinn goes, do you need help teaching in Africa? I think he's gunning for a job.
Oh, Sam can come over anything. I like Sam. We were supposed to have a match in Grapple Fest and COVID ruined that. But yeah, super nice guy.
I guess you've got you've got that and I'm sure you've got a few other comps that you're you're hoping to do when you come back to the UK?
I think I'm like everyone else. I think we didn't know what we had until it was gone. So I will be doing every competition possible.
And the final question from people on Instagram is, will you return? Will he return to Serbia again to try to learn to how to wrestle? I feel like I'm not sure how I feel about that one. Try to learn how to wrestle. You take that as you will.
I'm working hard all the time, so the 6-year-olds of Serbia are in trouble when I come back. The kids' class is getting fucked up.
You know, if you self-identify it as a 6-year-old, then you can enter the kids' competitions.
Just got to believe in myself.
Exactly. You can do it, man.
But yeah, there's like 20-year-old kids there that have been training since they were about 10, and yeah, they threw me about a little bit. it's probably one of those guys that's asked that question.
It probably is. It's jaw-dropping sometimes to see just the level of some of these kids in countries like Serbia, where, I mean, they've put in more hours. They've put in almost as many hours as an adult who's been training 10 years has by the time they're in their teens.
Yeah, 100%. That is one thing that actually, you know, if I do get to have a full-time gym, that's one huge thing that I took away from Serbia. So I used to just see kids' classes as like a way for the instructor to make a little bit extra money on the side and do a little bit for the community, help kids out and stuff. What I didn't think was like the guys at Kimura really see that as like an investment. So like the 18 to 20-year-olds that are kicking my ass in wrestling, they are products of the kids' class. So I like when I have my own gym, I 100% be doing kids' classes just with a view to, you know, by the time these guys are 16, they'll be giving me, you know, a hard role. And you see that with like Nicky Bryan and the Real Toros. You didn't really see it in the early days because guys were starting jiu-jitsu at like 25, 30. And they're a little bit older by the time they get good. But nowadays, there's 12-year-olds that could beat me up, which is sad.
I think they could beat most of us up, though.
Oh, yeah. Real Toros are insane. Nicky Bryan's insane.
I think it's interesting as well because it's such a question mark around what is the best way to train a kid between kind of strict technique and play and practice and sparring. Like, I think there's so many more question marks over even as adults, we question what is the best format, you know, things like, do you do a warm up? How much time do you spend drilling? How much live sparring? Well, I feel like that question gets doubled even more when it's kids.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm absolutely not the authority to asking that. I'm still working it out. But I've got high-level black belts around me who are friends, and I can kind of question on that. But right now, I wouldn't have an answer for you. I've yet to do kids' classes. I think I'm going to set them up in Nairobi and just feel it out, see what the kids like. See, this is a kind of experiment for me. See how well I can teach these kids. What works, what doesn't, and hopefully take that to the next place.
And have you kind of, not questioned, but have you looked at how you teach, and has that transformed over the kind of the time you spent in each of these gyms in different countries?
Yeah, 100%, 100%. I think the way you teach is also the most important thing for a coach. But I think for me, it's just looking at places that I've done it correctly, and just trying to copy them. Like, I've got a Flow subscription and they're quite good for giving you little snippets of what the Danaher guys are up to. Daisy Fresh was really cool. I don't know if you've seen Daisy Fresh, but it was a really interesting look at, you know, how you can coach with very little and have great results. I took a lot from that. And Lachlan Giles has actually done a lot of really good podcasts on coaching methods and stuff like that. So I like to think of myself as like a kind of student coach just now. I'm able to do it in places, but I'm always trying to improve. And luckily enough, these really high level coaches are quite open about how they do it and what they're doing and what they're thinking is working for them. So I think as just a coach, I'm just always learning how to try and be better.
Well, I mean, it is a growing thing. You'll never, I guess similar to learning jiu-jitsu, it never really stops. It just kind of, you just keep learning something, yeah, and that happens in either a month or 3 or a year, and it just depends on what you're learning and how you learn.
Yeah, 100%. And it's the same thing. Everywhere you go, someone kicks your ass with some new technique that you've not seen before, and then you spend a couple of months and then you get to add that technique to your arsenal. So it's kind of doing the same thing with coaching. You just learn ways of treating people and talking to people.
That is very true. Before we finish up the interview, I do a little quick fire round at the end of every episode. It's something with our guests that is usually quite an amusing thing, and it's just quite interesting to see what they answer.
Cool.
And I think I might add one more question to this as well, because I think it'd be a good one. But we'll crack on if you're happy to.
Okay, what's that?
So the first one is nice and easy, acai, yay or nay?
Massive yay, love it.
Yes. Your favorite BJJ moment from traveling?
A personal one?
Yeah.
Watching Sammy beat up that guy in the beach, that was fun.
Pull guard or takedowns? This would be an interesting one since you've spent some time now doing some takedowns.
Yeah, the answer's less concrete than it used to be, but it's still pull guard for me.
Is factor 50 high enough?
I have a natural immunity to the sun. You can put me in the equator and it just bounces off me. I think I'm too white to tan. You can ask a scientist about that.
It's a phenomenon.
Yeah, like worst case scenario, I go a little bit red for a day and then I'm back to white.
More people travel through BJJ?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, not everyone can do it. Not everyone is stupid enough to leave their job and just live off some savings for a few months. But even with holidays and stuff, you should always go and see what everyone else is up to.
The Scottish delicacy that you miss?
It's a UK one, but the Morrison's meal deal.
What is the Morrison's meal deal?
It's £3. You get a sandwich, a drink, and a snack for £3. And it's just an easy lunch. If you can't think what to have for lunch, you just get a Morrison's meal deal. And they don't do that shit here, and it annoys me.
If only Kenya could have a Morrison's, for God's sake.
Well, they've got supermarkets, but it's all those pesky fresh ingredients that you have to do stuff with. And you have to cook
it. Who wants to cook?
Who wants healthy cooked meals?
This is probably, I'm not saying it's true, but you know, that thing about everyone in Kenya being in shape and the UK not so much, it might have something to do with that, but we'll breeze over that.
I mean, avocados are like 20p here. It's crazy.
What?
Yeah, like avocados, all the amazing healthy stuff that's really expensive back home, it's cheap here. And I hate it because it makes me, I need to eat it. I just want to eat a sandwich out of a bag. What the good old days.
To all those listeners, please send Morrison's meal deals to Jack. ADCC or IBJJF?
ADCC by a mile. So much more
every
fun.
Time. Will you ever try Senegalese wrestling?
Yeah, I mean, I could maybe get £250 out of you being framed if I was to try it.
It's a good money. Is it punches to the head or just punches to the body? Can't remember, because there is punching involved, isn't there?
Well, I'd be throwing myself to the ground and asking for the DQ if that happened.
It is crazy. I think there's a couple of documentaries. There's definitely it might be the Frank Grillo documentary where he goes and tries different martial arts around the world.
That's cool.
But go check it out, because there's one where he goes to Senegal and they literally like pack football stadiums with these people.
Crazy.
It's awesome. It's what's most interesting about that is that. That's what you kind of hope BJJ could be and wrestling could be in the UK. don't get me wrong, you know, you fill a sports hall or like the Crystal Palace Centre or something like that, but you'd want it to be like these people get marched down the street, paraded down the street as if they've just come back from winning, I don't know, this is where my lack of football comes in, the Premier Champions League, there you go.
Betfred Cup.
You know, they're literally heroes.
Yeah, yeah, and to be honest, I thought I would get a little bit of that coming to Kenya, but it's not quite in Kenya yet.
Maybe I need to go. You can be that hero. You can be the hero in Kenya.
The Kenyan wrestling champion. First in a division of one.
kids, absolute champ.
As long as the surfing kids don't come down, I've got a chance.
Exactly. As long as they don't get wind, we'll be good. Where did we get to? How many languages have you sort of picked up, if any?
Sort of zero. To be honest, everyone speaks really good English everywhere I've been. What did I get? I keep getting called Mzungu here. So I asked the guys what Mzungu is, and it means kind of white lost traveller, white clueless traveller.
Is that the new fight nickname then?
It could be. I asked the guys, you know, is that offensive? And the guy said, to be fair, you are very white and you are lost right now. So I was like, because I just kind of, like, I couldn't find it. Like, the gym's hidden in the mosque, so I was just wandering around. I tried to walk into the mosque in a pair of tight shorts and my shoes, and about four people ran at me, pushing me out, saying you can't do that. And then I was saying, oh no, but I need to train, you need to let me in. So yeah, I'd live up to the Mzungu title. That could be my fight nickname.
Jack Mzungu Brown. We'll get the poster ready for the next Grapple Fest.
Yes, we can put the brightness right up to make me extra weight.
Will Kenya become a country of leg lockers?
Eventually, if they come along, definitely. And have that guard passing nonsense.
Your favorite post comp food? If you say Morrison's meal, they'll I'm gonna go.
No, it's probably Nando's. But I love going to the competitions when there's the acai stalls because it's lovely. You just can't really find the acai that's as good as that stuff in the supermarkets.
It must be, given if you can get avocados for 20p, there's got to be one supermarket in Kenya that sells acai somewhere.
Well, the coach here is Brazilian, so if anyone's going to know, he'll know. I'll go and ask him.
And finally, this would be a good one, I reckon. We ask this for every guest. If someone were to play you in a movie, who would it be and what kind of movie would it be?
Ah, fuck. who would play me? I was just like, I really like the Nicolas Cage movies where he just sees how cheesy it can be with the action. Like, I probably want someone like him to play me, and just for every scene, just to be like beating up 20 guys, taking the girl under his arm, and then walking away from the explosion without looking at it. That would make me happy. The Jack Brown story.
The Jack Brown story, which is, yeah, so Nick Cage losing his shit.
Beating up
a load of people.
Beating up a lot of Serbian 6-year-olds. And then running out the gym as an explosion hits. But he doesn't even look at the explosion because he's too cool for it.
Then just makes his way off to Kenya with his fiance in his arm.
Yeah, and she's just like, oh, Jack. Amazing.
Outstanding.
It's what she usually does.
I mean, credit to her. I think there's not many people who would be like, yeah, let's head off to all these different countries, train and do jiu-jitsu and stuff. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, so there's not many people who can put up with me full stop. Never mind when I'm going traveling to different gyms. She's amazing, so supportive. Even today, and like, I woke up at 7 a.m. to sit and type stuff for a jiu-jitsu Facebook page, and she's not complained once. She's great.
And I guess you've you've been guided in the in kind of traveling in some countries that she may have visited, or is that yet to come when you go to Asia finally?
No, it's the other way around. Just me using common sense. Like, she'll walk anywhere. Like, it's like 12 o'clock, well, not 12 o'clock here because there's a curfew, but like 12 o'clock at night, pitch black, and she'll be like, oh, I'm just going to walk to the shops. It's like, no, you're not. You get kidnapped. I don't have the relevant funds to get you back. When you get kidnapped, you're not going outside.
That it's a practicality thing. It's that I don't have the money to get you back.
Unless these terrorists want some jiu-jitsu lessons in exchange for the return of my fiance, then I'm fucked. So no, it's me looking after her. She doesn't give a fuck.
Well, that's good to know. That's good to know that at least that you're looking out for her.
Always.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for coming on. It's been a real interesting insight into just how I think we can always forget what jiu-jitsu like is out there in other bits of the world. We can be quite insular and imagine that the UK is the home of jiu-jitsu and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it is a real fascinating insight talking to you.
Amazing, man. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
And if there's anywhere that people want to direct themselves to, where should they have a look?
Probably just my Instagram, Jack Brown BJJ. Send me a message. I'll say hi.
Brilliant. Send Morrison's
meal deal. I like the chicken sandwich. I like the double Snickers bar, and the innocent smoothies. Thanks very much, guys.
you heard it, people. Get the man his meal deal. Thanks, Jack.
Cheers, mate. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. To keep up to date with all our latest stuff, follow us at The Prodigy Podcast on Instagram.